Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of the late Cormac McCarthy, whose novels about wayward characters in the rural American South and Southwest are noted for their dark violence, dense prose, and stylistic complexity. During his long career, McCarthy wrote 12 novels, 2 plays, 5 screenplays, and 3 short stories, many of them in the Western and post-apocalyptic genres. The recipient of both a Guggenheim Fellowship and a MacArthur Fellowship, he also won a number of literary awards, including the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His most notable works include Blood Meridian, All the Pretty Horses, The Road, and No Country for Old Men. For this episode, we are pleased to speak with Amit Majmudar and Fernando A. Flores. Please check out their impressive bios in the show notes. Amit and Fernando are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you, Amit and Fernando, for joining me today on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm excited to talk about Cormac McCarthy with you. And as luck would have it, we're recording this today on July 20th, which would have been his 90th birthday. So very fortuitous time for us to get together and talk about McCarthy. But first, can I want to know a little bit about yourselves and, you know, for our listeners to get to know you both a little bit, and your connection to McCarthy as well. Amit, perhaps you'd like to get us going?
Sure. My name is Amit Majmudar. I'm a Ohio-based writer. I write all sorts of different things. You know, I kind of started out with poetry. That's where probably most of my publications are. But I've also published novels, both in the United States and in India. And probably my relationship to McCarthy, besides one of abject admiration and love, is I've always considered him a guiding light in my practice of fiction, particularly for my first novel, which is Partitions. It was published by Holt in 2011. And I think any reader of that would probably be able to detect the influence of The Road and influence of Blood Meridian in particular. I think at that time I hadn't yet read the Border Trilogy, but I was already, even at that point, if anyone ever asked me the question, who's your favorite living writer? I wouldn't even blink. It would just be like Cormac McCarthy. And it was really on the basis of Blood Meridian alone, but The Road kind of reinforced it for me. And so, yeah, I think that I write a lot of different things, a lot of things that Cormac McCarthy never particularly put his hand to. But when it comes to the things that Cormac McCarthy did put his hand to, fiction, I try to learn from him as much as possible. I always have. And I continue to do so.
Yeah, that's great. Fernando, how about yourself?
That's super interesting to me. Yeah. My name is Fernando Flores. I'm what you would call, like, I'm a writer from South Texas. I guess my last 3 books have been South Texas oriented. I have 2 collections of short stories, one, Death to the Bullshit Artist, South Texas, and my most recent book is called Valley-esque. It came out last year. It's also a collection of short stories. And I have a novel called Tears of the Trophy Pig that all kind of deal with the border, Texas, and among other things, of course. And I suppose I'm trying to think of when I first... You know, when I first started writing, I was one of those writers who avoided writers. You know, I grew up around a lot of people who were very hardcore into the beat writers, you know. So when I was like 18, 19, I was like, I'm not going to read the beat writers. And I was like, I'm anti-beat writer. I became anti-beat writers for some reason, even though I kind of reversed my position later on in life, like I did about so many other writers, including Cormac McCarthy, because he was one of those writers who I just avoided, you know. And I don't know why, and only certain kinds of, maybe because only certain kinds of people read Cormac McCarthy at that time, and they tended to be certain kinds of, I guess, young men like myself, but who I didn't really get along with, maybe aesthetically. People who are they're very stark realists. Realists tend to be very, very stark about what their ideas of literature are, at least then, at least the people who I was around with then. eventually, like around the time when I was 25, I'm 41 now. So I'm around 2007, maybe around the time that the movie came out, that the old No Country for Old Men movie came out. And finally, I think that was my first one that I read. I read that one, and then I read The Road almost back to back. I remember I had the movie copy of No Country for Old Men. I tore the cover off. Because it had the movie poster. I hated seeing I think it had like a weird like Javier Bardem's like stark face looking at you or something. And I just tore it off and I was just reading it. I think I read the whole thing pretty fast. I don't know. That was my first, and I was struck by, I think what struck me about it first is that, you know, I also was learning that he wrote it as a screenplay first. He wrote it as a screenplay, and after it didn't get made, I think he had it sit around for like 10 years or for a long time, something like that. And then he adapted, I guess, his own screenplay into the novel, No Country for Old Men. And if you read it, it kind of makes sense. You know, it has those long monologues that I guess Tommy Lee Jones ends up delivering in the movie. They adapted a certain way, you know. So that was interesting to me how perhaps the style of it dictated, you know, that it was an adaptation of his own screenplay. That was interesting for me at the time. And that just stayed with me for a long time. It took me a while to read Blood Meridian. I actually didn't read Blood Meridian until like 3 years ago. And I'm glad I waited that long, really. I'm glad I waited that long. But anyway, yeah, let's go on to, that's my initial foray. Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting to me on the level of that your encounter with McCarthy was at least initially kind of changed by your notion of who was reading him. So in my case, I'd actually never heard of him before. More importantly, I had no idea who was reading him. I was in my radiology residency at the time, and I was going to study for my board exam in this big university library in downtown Cleveland. And every time I would go into the stacks with my textbooks and my big thing, you know, all this stuff I had to memorize, I'd get distracted and I'd go in the stacks and I'd wander around the stacks. And, you know, I love, because my first love is literature and my last love is literature. Radiology is what I do to pay the bills, right? And my natural tendency, as I said, I'm into poetry. I'm into a lot of classical literature. So if you put me into any university library, the first place I go, poetry, classical literature, European literature, Indian literature, translations from the Sanskrit, translations from the Greek and Latin. I always like find out what their collection has. Now, it just so happened that I was like, I think I was looking for a bathroom or something, because then I wandered into their fiction territory, which I usually just never would go to. And then I'm walking and I just stopped dead cold, okay, for no reason. And I turned to my right, and I still remember, I have the vivid, you know, mental image of this moment. And I reach out and I pick out a book seemingly at random, only it wasn't at random. It was like the gods putting my hand there. And it's this old beat up copy of Blood Meridian hardback without the dust jacket on. And I take it out and I have no reason, I have no knowledge, no understanding of why I've just picked this book out of nowhere. And it's called Blood Meridian or the Evening, or the Evening Redness in the West. Okay. Yeah. And right off the bat, that was very intriguing to me, because I was expecting to see a typical 20th century novel title page. And then something else happened. I kind of looked at it again, and it had a slightly old-timey font where it has like little summaries of what's going to be in the chapter with little dashes between them, kind of. Mm. And that's something that I recognized from like old Jules Verne novels and old 19th century books. So right off the bat, I was kind of like, this is a little odd. What's this all about? And then I just started reading, you know, a page at random. I don't remember what page it was, but the thing about Blood Meridian is you can open it up to any page and you get sucked in, because the language on every page is at full bore. You know, it's full, all systems go on every page. And I read, you know, a few paragraphs and I was like, I'm in the presence of something, you know. The very fact that I picked this one book out of like, there's literally hundreds of books that I've been passing as I'm wandering through there. And the fact that I picked this one, and it turns out to be this weird linguistic beast. It was kind of like I was reading a poem, only it was better than any poem I'd read in recent memory. And that was my, and I had no idea who Cormac McCarthy was, and I had no idea who typically read him. I didn't know if it was a work of stark realism or magical realism or what, but I just got into it, and man, I never looked back.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. I had a similar experience with the writer Celine, the French writer.
Celine. He's interesting. He's
back
interesting.
In like 20, in like in like 21 years ago. I was also had a, almost identical to your experience, actually. I was a video technician at the university in South Texas at then. Uh-huh. And I used to wander. With my bag, just cleaning equipment all day. And I just go into the library sometimes for hours while they think that I was working, you know, and I just read books. The same thing happened to me. I saw it, like, what the hell is it? And I grabbed it, and it was Journey to the End of the Night. And
yeah, you know, Celine.
I didn't know anything about it, but I just opening the same kind of experience. I opened that book, and I was like, what the hell is this? You know, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, we could do a whole separate podcast about Celine, because with him, it brings you right up front and close and personal against the question of, like, the life or, like, the man and the art. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Because apparently he was wildly racist. They've even got unpublished manuscripts by him that exist now in French. And they're completely off the wall. And like they discovered a new one.
But at the time, like, you don't know anything about
him. You don't know anything about him. Right. You know, right. Just, exactly.
You read it and you're like, the text itself, you're like, what the hell? You never read anything like
that. Exactly.
So that's super interesting to me. And what do you think about the epigraphs too? Do you ever think about the epigraphs?
Let me refresh my, Valérie Bohme. Yeah, that was another element, actually, because I had, you know, I'd read Valérie as, you know, this aesthetic kind of poet, French, you know, and then I knew that Bohme was like, I thought he was, at least, I don't know, I've never read him, but I knew that he was some kind of mystic, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, what is the conjunction of all this stuff relative to things like the Santa Cruz Valley, San Bernardino, wild bulls, Tumacacori, the mission, a hermit, you know, I think those initial, you know, the return to camp, the idiot delivered, you know, like a confrontation, the tumbril burned, you know, another baptism, judge and fool, like those little phrases at the beginning of each chapter, they're really, really effective in just making you want to find out what this is all about, you know?
And that's
also seems like a demented.
Yeah, Blood Meridian does that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It also seems like a demented outline for himself. Like, if you're going to, like write a book, you're like, okay, this chapter needs to have all these things in
there. Right. But, you know, if you set that, so you know what they should do? They should have, like, a contest where people who haven't read Blood Meridian, they just get those chapter, you know, pre-titles. And it's like, construct a book, you know, with chapters with this.
That would be an interesting game
to play. Interesting contest, you know?
Totally. Yeah. I've always had like a similar kind of, like, I've always wanted like people, like get five different people to like rewrite the Great Gatsby again. You know, we all know the Great Gatsby and what it is, you know?
Nice.
All
of us know. Nice.
Like everybody, like five people rewrite it, do your new
Great Gatsby.
Like as a literary experiment, you know.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's fun. I like that.
Like a Borges kind of experiment.
Funny you should mention Borges. Cormac McCarthy was a huge fan of Borges. He considered Borges to be world class. He was not a fan of García Márquez, which is interesting.
I bet. Of course. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, he thought Borges was top.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You know, I think. Yeah, because you know, it makes sense. Cormac McCarthy's language, like, to me, is very, like, clinical to me. You know, it's very precise, you know, just, like, that kind of language, like, clinical kind of language just gets to the point and tells you exactly, like, what needs to happen, you know? So he kind of, like, to me, I always think about, that's the word that comes to mind when I'm reading his prose, you know, when I'm revisiting it, you know, and I say that in a positive way, you know, in a very positive way.
It's kind of like which Cormac McCarthy you're talking about, because I can think of books by Cormac McCarthy where he's being very spare, stark, clinical, and very often very simple sentences and things like that.
Yeah.
And then there's Blood Meridian where he just takes the regulator off. And he just lets it flow, and it's purple passage after purple passage, you know. And there's like that description of like the mules falling off the side of the mountain, and they've got mercury in the sacks, and the mercury turns into these balls, and the balls of mercury collect. It's completely unnecessary, all that description, and like, and yet he just does it. And there have been books by McCarthy that I've read where I'm like, do the Blood Meridian thing again, you know, like go off, you know, go off. And like, but he was just capable of, you know, and that's something that we talk about, McCarthy's style, or, you know, McCarthy being a certain way. But what was very interesting is that he had one of the largest stylistic ranges of any writer that I'm familiar with, to be honest with you, within the field of prose. Because even if you look at, you know, his last novel, Stella Maris, he's got all these passages about the science, about sciences and physics and things like that.
Wow.
And you juxtapose that kind of stuff where he's talking about, you know, nuclear bombs and Oppenheimer and Hiroshima and the science of it and mathematics. He's talking about all this complex mathematical stuff. And then you juxtapose that with some of the passages of thick description in Blood Meridian, which are super poetic, and then some of the stark, you know, pared down violent scenes in No Country for Old Men. And it's hard to just keep all that in your mind at one time and say, this all came out of the same guy. And it's all kind of peak examples of that kind of writing.
Yeah.
And when you try and think to yourself, okay, did all, you know, other famous writers, did Philip Roth ever do that? Did Updike ever pull that off? Did David Foster Wallace ever pull that off? Did whoever, you name it, did they ever pull that kind of range off? And my answer would be, if they did, I haven't seen it yet. You know what I'm saying? And you know, even, and you can even go further back and say, look, Tolstoy, Proust, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody had this kind of range. Very unusual. Very unusual.
Yeah, what is interesting also that it's all very like genre, you know, like the Western, the sci-fi book, you know, they're all very like, you can point them, you can know, they're all very easily classifiable. They're not like esoteric, like Moby Dick would be, you know, like.
See, but yeah, but if you think about it, so much of what we consider quote unquote great literature comes directly out of genres. So like, technically, yeah. Moby Dick is an example of the seafaring or whaling tale.
Yeah, that was
very popular in the 19th century, right? And Hamlet is simply the best of all the Elizabethan revenge tragedies that were being written. You know, and if you, and actually, it brings up another thing. So, my favorite living writer was Cormac McCarthy. Alas, my favorite living director, movie director, is Christopher Nolan. Right, and Nolan also goes into a genre and then does something amazing with it. So the Dark Knight trilogy is the superhero movie. Interstellar is a sci-fi movie, you know, and this is kind of like, you know, the idea of genre, like it's basically every literary form deals with, you know, it basically takes reader expectation and then it does something amazing with it. If it's a good example of that genre. And that's so you kind of need the baseline expectations in place in the reader, and then you take it to the next level of high literature. So you take the Wailing Tale, if you're Herman Melville, you take the Wailing Tale, everybody knows Wailing Tale, he himself had written best-selling Wailing Tales early in his career,
right? And
now I'm going to take you somewhere else with this same thing. You expect these guys to be on the sea, but I'm going to do something crazy with it. Blood Meridian, it's a Western. Okay, we all know how the Western works, they go around on horses. Oh, Cormac McCarthy says, I'm going to do something crazy with this. You're not going to see this coming. You're going to recognize it, but it's going to be strange. And then it's going to be even stranger. And by the end of this book, you're going to realize that, yeah, I wrote a Western, but I also wrote a completely idiosyncratic work of literature.
Wow.
And both of those things, same time, they both are classified as a Western, classified as an utterly idiosyncratic, unrepeatable, unreplicable masterwork of literature. And that's kind of what I love about McCarthy. I also love it about Nolan.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, to me, like, I wonder how much Blood Meridian is like, I don't know, him struggling with his drinking, you know, and early on and later on, contrasting like the journey that the novel does and knowing how long it took him to write it. You know, I think it took him a long time to write it from from his conception. I think the whole thing was like 11 years or maybe even longer.
I didn't know that. Wow.
So I think he quit drinking sometime in the late 70s or something like that, you know. So I wonder, because that, you know, the beginning of that novel, there's a lot of like something to me, the beginning of that novel and the end of that novel are like almost like two different novels in what goes on in them. It almost has like a circular kind of narrative to me. It reminds me of like 2001: A Space Odyssey in many ways, and the narrative, in the way the narrative works, you know. And you know, that last image of Blood Meridian, you know, that last little bit, like the little epilogue or whatever, reminds me of like the baby at the end of 2001: Space Odyssey. Just narratively speaking, you know, you're like, okay, you know, this is how this ends. Great, I guess. Like, you know, but right. it's still like nothing you've ever seen before or experienced before, you know. And it's this, I don't know, it's complex narrative wise, you know. Even if it's, to me, like, I enjoy the circular notion. Like, people who talk about it are like, well, nothing ever happens. They're just writing from one town to town, creating mayhem everywhere they go. And that's just pretty much seems to be it, right? Like, over and over until the end. And also, like, I guess the troubling aspects of it, like, to me, are like the philosophy in it, I guess, like, men like dominating other men by, I don't know, raping and killing them and scalping them, you know. Is that the thing? You know, there's all these things in it that I really don't hear people grapple with too much, and it's criticisms of it, you know.
Yeah.
Do you all have any thoughts?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the ending of Blood Meridian is its relationship to Elizabethan tragedy, Shakespearean tragedy. So Melville, so McCarthy's favorite novel was Moby Dick, as you can imagine, right? Mm-hmm. And Melville was basically based Moby Dick very heavily on Shakespeare. So Ahab is a very Shakespearean character with these monologues. And Melville was also a poet, and he would put runs of iambic pentameter into Moby Dick. Okay. And so at the end of Blood Meridian, there's a scene where basically the judge is dancing, right? And the interesting thing is that the end of Elizabethan or you know, Shakespearean tragedies, and it was a convention of the time, you know, everyone's bloody, everyone's been run through, and they're all lying on the ground, dead, blood, stage blood all over them. But before the curtain, all the characters would get up and dance a jig in front of the audience. So the judge dancing at the end of Blood Meridian is a direct analogy or a direct descendant of the Elizabethan tragic custom of having all the dead characters and all the, you know, the villain, the hero, this guy, the other, they all get up and they all dance at the end of it. And the other thing that I found very interesting about when you said philosophy, the philosophy of Blood Meridian. You know, I read Blood Meridian first and then The Road. And between the two, you'll notice that Blood Meridian is kind of like the poetry of nihilism, right? And there's that, like what you were describing, scalping, going from place to place, nothing. There's no arc of redemption, right? There's this glimmer of light at the end of The Road where the boy finds another, you actually think the boy's going to be eaten, I think, at the end of it, because the dad's, you know, on his way out. But then it's like he finds this other family. There's this glimmer of hope. It's kind of like it's so there's this change that happened, I think, perhaps within McCarthy himself, where he lightened up a little bit, you know, a little. The end of Blood Meridian has no light. It has the judge dancing. It's kind of like a triumph of horror. Horror is triumphant. Just as in an Elizabethan tragedy, a lot of times, you know, Lear and Cordelia, they're all dead, you know. In the play on which King Lear was based, that wasn't the ending. Cordelia didn't die in the original King Lear. So King Lear was based on an anonymous play that Shakespeare reworked into the modern King, or into the King Lear that we know. And the other interesting thing I find about philosophy and McCarthy is that you will encounter McCarthy's sources or readings. He was very widely read. He was astonishingly widely read. And you'll encounter him, his sources very at random almost. So one of my favorite books of sort of nonfiction philosophy is this book by a Dutch, 20th century Dutch thinker named Johan Huizinga. And it's called Homo Ludens. And it's about play. It's about all the different ways in which human activity, art, war, music, poetry, literature, society, everything is based on games and play. Okay. And I'm reading the chapter about, it's entitled Play and War, all right, in Huizinga. And I found the exact, almost not the exact, but basically I found the passage that McCarthy transfigured into the judge's discussion of games of skill and games of chance, where he talks about the machinery of the universe comes clanking to this one turn of the card, everything is wagered on it, and you know, this, that, the other. It's this really beautiful, eloquent passage where the judge explains how war is God because it's the ultimate game. And this is, and I found the exact same thing in Huizinga, and I researched a little bit, and it turns out he had read Huizinga. He had, you know, derived some of these ideas from Huizinga. And it's so interesting to me to see, okay, here's this book of philosophy that I'm loving, and here's a passage that reminds me, has an uncanny resemblance to this obviously literarily transfigured passage in my favorite novel by my favorite writer. And there it is. And it turns out that, yes, he was there. He was there first. And now, in a Borgesian way, I read Huizinga through the prism of McCarthy. And it's enriched by the book that came after it.
That's incredible. That's so good. Wow.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. And that makes me think, like, that makes me think too, what are, we've mentioned some of McCarthy's other influences, like Melville, for example. But I'm in researching him, I've been fascinated by the influences of, like you just said, philosophy or, and the sciences as well. Like I've learned that he, I believe it was started as a physics major in college before dropping out. And had you know, maintained a passion for science throughout his whole life, you know, living close by the Santa Fe Institute, and working with them, and as yourself, who's also works in the sciences.
I'm a nuclear radiologist. Yeah, nuclear and general radiology. So I do kind of like nuclear medicine in addition to general radiology. So there's definitely a physics connection there, and I saw a lot of it come out in his last novel that I just read, Stella Maris.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, and I've really found that interesting too. And I feel like it's just one more example of how McCarthy kind of covers this spectrum, because a lot of his language is biblical. You know, a lot of his language is biblical, and if you look at the faith of contemporary Americans, it's kind of moved away from old time Christianity, old time biblical thinking, and it's moved toward a very, very intense faith in science and technology. And McCarthy has that covered as well. And so it's just a very impressive scope of his mind, I have to say. But it was very interesting to me to read about, you know, how he was talking about, you know, as you mentioned, the Santa Fe Institute, and how little interest he had in, you know, shooting the breeze with other writers, and he preferred the company of physicists. And I myself, I like everybody's company. I like hanging out with scientists, and I like hanging out with writers. But Fernando, I like to hear, as you yourself said, you yourself, when you were younger, you didn't like to kind of hang around with writers so much. And I was wondering what do you think of how McCarthy avoided writers? Like, what is the significance of that? How does that play into things, you know?
You know, that makes sense. I mean, he lived rurally most of his career. He was ignored for most of his career. Most of his career, we could say he almost nobody knew who he was, right? Or half of his career, right?
Yeah.
You could say that. So, I don't know. That's a long time. 20 years or something to not get a royalty check is a long time. I knew when I was doing my first book tour, I went to City Lights Books, where I met the legendary book buyer at City Lights, Paul Yamazaki, who's been the book buyer at City Lights since the late 60s. And he told me that back in the day, they got a letter from the publisher telling them that they were the bookstore that had sold more copies of Blood Meridian than any other bookstore in the nation, and that number did not exceed more than 20 copies. You know,
wow.
So, you know, that just, and that, but he was one of those booksellers from the very beginning that championed his work, you know, since the late 60s, you know, and he was one of those books, you know, one of those people that was there in the front lines of bookselling, where he was putting this book or this author into people's hands for years and years. And then eventually, after decades and decades, he blew up, you know.
The interesting thing about McCarthy's arc is that he sold very few copies, but he was understood to be a genius by a lot of other writers. And so he actually won a MacArthur Genius Grant before he wrote Blood Meridian, or before he published Blood Meridian.
I think he won one of the inaugural ones, right?
Right. And he basically, and he also won literary grants as late, you know, in the late 60s and in the 70s. And so the system was actually working, which is a very rare thing, right? Mm. Where system works, right? So it's very interesting that to me that at the time, readers had no interest in McCarthy and anything he was putting out. And I grant you that some of his earlier novels are perhaps not on the level of Blood Meridian, but then again, what is? You know, the Blood Meridian Border Trilogy, The Road, all those things came later in his career. But those early novels are nothing to sneeze at. But the system actually worked in McCarthy's case, which is that during those decades where he was out in the cold, which was probably about maybe 20 years or so, from the beginning to Blood Meridian, let's just say, or even a little bit after Blood Meridian, he really became famous with the Border Trilogy. Okay.
Yeah. With the, all the pretty horses, right?
All the pretty horses when and that's when he really, and by then, I think that's in the 90s, basically early 90s.
Yeah.
So you have at least two decades where nobody out in the market is paying any attention to him, but there are writers who single him out and they tell the MacArthur Foundation, you know, that's how the MacArthur Foundation works. They go out and they reach out to people and they say, who deserves this? And they reached out and they pointed at that guy that no one was reading. And they said, that guy. Hmm. And he had some other grants too, that allowed him to sustain himself. Because if you read about how he lived during that time, he was very monastic.
Yeah.
All right. And he would be eating beans out of a can with his wife. And she'd be like, there's a famous anecdote that was going around social media a while back where his wife was like, you know, people would come to him and be like, hey, we'd like you to talk about your novels at this university. Would you mind coming to talk to, we'll give you a couple thousand dollars or whatever, which was a lot of money back in the 70s or whatever. And he'd be like, everything I want to say is on the page. And then they just go back to eating beans, you know, in a shack. And it's pretty astonishing to know about just how, first of all, how monastic he was about his art and how averse he was to the chattering classes, you know, how averse he was. Mm. That he's hand to mouth. He's living hand to mouth. He's, you know, he has no money and no readers, but he just can't bring himself to go and spend, you know, a day or two at a university or just to talk about literature. He's mortally opposed to commentary on literature. And that's one thing I've noticed about him, which is that he was even reluctant to give interviews. And, he took Oprah. I think it was Oprah who kind of broke that down. He was Salinger-like in that regard, where he doesn't like to talk about his own books. Doesn't even like to talk too much about books, period, or much less write a book of literary criticism. And it puts me in mind of another, well, actually who was once my favorite living literary critic, but now no more, George Steiner. And he would talk about the opposition between literature and writing about literature. And he was like, no matter how good your literary criticism is, it is always intrinsically subordinate to creative work, fiction, poetry, this, that, the other. So no matter what brilliant thing you say about literature or write about literature, the literature is intrinsically superior to it. And I think that in McCarthy's case, he really, or maybe, I don't know if he knew about Steiner's ideas on this, but he definitely lived that way, which is that he did not waste any time. He didn't waste time writing reviews for The New Yorker, writing book, you know, essays about other writers and essays about his favorite book and this and that, which is something I do all the time, even though I know that Steiner's right about this and that McCarthy's right about this. It's hard to resist. It's you just want to get out and do that. Not McCarthy. He was very monastic in his dedication. And he says, you know, a true monk is not going to sit there and write love poems. A monk is going to write his poems to the divine, right? If he writes at all. And yeah. and that's, I find that very admirable. Even if I can't imitate it, I don't feel capable of imitating that kind of dedication, but he lived like that. And I think he believed that in his bones.
That's interesting. Also considering his inclination to write screenplays, that was like, you know, that seems to be like an exception, like in his writing, like he did write screenplays, a couple of screenplays.
He did, but for him, I mean, remember,
but that's interesting to me. Like,
that's drama, right? That's like playwriting.
Totally, totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it makes me interesting. It makes me wonder about the influence of like cinema in his work, like even like a movie like The Wild Bunch in contrast with like Blood Meridian, the influence is undeniably there of The Wild Bunch, you know, or something like that. That's if I can compare it to any other work of art that exists, it would have to be that. So I don't know. It's interesting to me. You know, he also, what was the name of the other screenplay he wrote that ended up being shot?
I think
The Counselor. You know, and that's interesting to me. And also like the other play, he wrote a play also. What is it called? I don't know, but that is interesting to me. Like, yeah, like how he did consider that. He must have considered that like a different kind of art form. And he must have had some kind of like his respect for screenwriting. People always, you know, talk about, I mean, disrespect screenwriters and stuff, but he must have had like a respect for the art form. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done it, like in like all those other things, you know?
And absolutely. And I think it's important to remember that, like in Shakespeare's time, playwrights were not considered high art. You know, it wasn't considered high art.
Mm.
And
interesting.
In our day, it's very analogous. Screenwriters are not considered high literary artists. Although if you look at an Aaron Sorkin, I mean, that's as tight dialogue as you're going to find anywhere, right?
Or right.
So I think in McCarthy's case, like what I can sense of, I mean, I've looked at some of those screenplays and I've seen, you know, the way in which cinematic elements enter his fiction writing.
Yeah.
I think that for him, it was not a stark binary between high and low culture, because the way McCarthy was, he was kind of indifferent to social perceptions of the prestige of given forms of writing. Okay. So it's of a piece with his not wanting to deal with the chattering classes, not giving interviews, not worrying about how his books weren't selling. It's because he was so monastically drilled down on that thing, which is like art, right? His art. That he didn't care if people thought screenwriting is less prestigious than fiction writing. He's going to do what he sees. He's going to bring his vision into being, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And make it and manifest it in language. And that's another thing, you know, that I find beautiful about McCarthy, you know, that he really is just like, he's like, you know, you can think what you want to think. You can love me or you can forget about me and ignore me. It's going to be like this, you know? And Melville was like that. He learned that from Melville. So epic poems in the 19th century, I mean, there was no real market for it. Longfellow kind of pulled a few off. Melville, late in his life, he created this huge epic about a religious pilgrimage called Clarel. His novels after Moby Dick, well, first of all, Moby Dick itself is a perfect example of, I'm going to do my thing and we'll see how it plays. After Moby Dick, he wrote a bunch of novels nobody was interested in. They were very strange, you know, Pierre or The Confidence Man or this, these other, there's a few of them I have not even touched, but I kind of browsed through them and I know about them. And I know about their reception, which is that nobody cared about them. This was the same Melville who had been a bestseller with his Taipei and Umu and some of these other ones, Umu or whatever, that he'd seafaring tales he'd written when he was younger. But he was like, you know, he's like, I have my vision, I'm gonna do my thing, you know? And McCarthy was like that. He was like his master, Melville. He was very much.
It's interesting. You know, the writer that Cormac McCarthy reminds me of the most is actually Toni Morrison, you know? Toni Morrison, like the gothic, dark kind of elements in her work, to me, are very, very parallel to Cormac McCarthy's. And both of them probably also had similar influences, you know, all, you know, from William Faulkner to Moby Dick and all these other mid 20th century authors that influenced their work. But that's who I always, you know, there was a moment in time where I read their works back to back, and they complemented each other very well, you know, in my opinion, you know. So
that's so strange, because for my first novel, Cormac McCarthy and Toni Morrison. And I was like, these are my two guiding lights for my first novel.
Wow. You know,
kind of funny to put them two together.
That's well. Interesting. That's interesting. You know, strange. And the trajectory of the careers like are similar to me. Like neither of them really had a lot of readers in the beginning, you know?
Not early on.
And then they blew up, like, I don't know, like when Beloved came out.
And Beloved is another example of a genre story that is then transfigured into high art, because it's kind of a ghost story, right? You know,
and
it is transfigured into high art. It's the greatest ghost story probably ever written in all of the literature, you know, as far as concerned.
What do you think about the esoteric, the even like the almost what you would call like, I don't know, fantastical elements in Blood Meridian, like that moment where like a lake just vanishes? Do you remember that moment where like, I don't know, like 100 pages into the book, where there's this beautiful lake or whatever, and they go to sleep and then they wake up and the lake is gone? Do you remember that moment?
I read it was a while ago, but it sounds about right.
and it's like inexplicable. Like it just goes there. You're describing the lake, and all of a sudden, like if you're reading and you're like, what the hell? And you just abandon it. You move past it. But also you're like, what the hell was that?
You know? The judge himself is a supernatural character.
You know, totally.
The role of the supernatural in Blood Meridian, I just think of the judge.
Yeah.
You know? And that guy, that character is, you know, he's larger than life to the point where he's larger than nature. He clearly has, I guess, you know, esoteric or at least some profound mythological background to this character.
Yeah.
And can I trace and parse exactly how, where, why his baldness, his gigantic nature, the way he speaks and the things he speaks about, the fact that he's a judge, you know, all those things have these vague conjunctions with mythology of various traditions, but you can't really pin it down. And that's part of its mystique and its aura and its appeal, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, those are the things that always stick with me. The supernatural kind of weird things, you know, like also like the, you know, you mentioned like the judge dancing in the end, but you know, what about the bear too? You know, remember the bear at the end?
And then there's actually little details too scattered throughout the prose itself. So like, they're taking off their shirts and there's this crazy amount of static, and like, there'll be some static when you take off a shirt, but the way Cormac McCarthy describes it, it's like they are covered in just stars and flashes of light, and it turns, the language is phantasmagorical. So it like, it takes something that's like real and it dials it up to the point where it's just like surreal.
Yeah. It reminds me of also like samurai movies, like Japanese samurai movies back then, they have an exaggerated amount of blood, like that is not real, that is just like just spray out blood. The blood in Blood Meridian is almost like that. It's almost like
it's absolutely that's a perfect analogy, actually.
Yeah,
that's a perfect analogy, exactly what it's like. And also there's some comic books that are like that, and there's an artistic value to that. Now some people have accused McCarthy of quote-unquote violence porn or utilizing violence and then beautifying violence. The argument could be made that that too is a very American characteristic. We do like blood and guts and video games where we go around shooting people. Modern day video games, shoot 'em up video games are very much similar. They're the descendants of, you know, the Glanton gang. But I think that, you know, if you truly believe that kind of art can be made of anything, if you truly believe that, you know, Nabokov's Lolita, right? What is that making art out of, right? You can make, if you really believe you can make art out of anything, then there's no reason to exclude violence, particularly when something like Homer also, you know, Homer's Iliad also partakes of this same thick description of violence, intricate description of violence. There's passages in Homer where, you know, Homer will tell you exactly where the spear point exits the guy who just got speared. He's like, it comes out right here. Right over his collarbone, and it sticks up near his ear, and that's how he got speared. And then you know, so there's something very Homeric about McCarthy too, and I think that in the road with that glimmer of compassion, that that human connection between the father and the son, you see McCarthy fully mature into an artist on this scale of Homer, and kind of the nature of Homer, I should say, of the nature of Homer, because Homer has this brutal scenes where, you know, Achilles is dragging Hector behind it. He's ruthless. He's dragging Hector behind his chariot. He's got his body there, and he sets up the funeral pyre for Patroclus, and he hangs 12 Trojan boys, or he kills Trojan boys as a sacrifice there. But then Priam comes and asks for his son's body. And then he softens a bit, and he kind of says, all right, you can take the body now, let's eat, basically, right? And then he breaks bread with the king of Troy, with the grieving king of Troy. And that's that glimmer of compassion in the road, and some of the human connection that you see in the Border Trilogy. Yeah. The painful love of brother and sister that you see in the last two novels. Blood Meridian, it's not of that nature. I think Blood Meridian is where he takes you into the abyss, and he kind of keeps you there. And he's like, you may look for light. You may look for that glimmer of light. You're not going to find it there.
No.
And he's just like, no, this is what darkness is. And people, you know, there's always survivorship bias where, you know, people are like, oh, you know, when you hear like the account of someone who survived something horrific, and they're like, but I found hope, and I found God, I found this, and whatever. You're seeing the survivorship bias. I mean, there's plenty of people who never survive, and that for them, it's pure darkness, right? And I think McCarthy in Blood Meridian shows you what absolute darkness looks like. And I honestly can't think of another work of literature that shows darkness in its absolute form to that same extent. And I think that the language was dialed up by him to this extent in order to make that darkness palatable or make it beautiful, or that's where it's almost like that's where the redemptive glimmer lies, within the language itself, within the poetry of that prose.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, to me, that's what I was trying to say. What I meant, like, that is language is like clinical to me. Like, I guess reading like Blood Meridian, I can't imagine that being glorified or anything like that. I can't imagine like reading that and being like, I want to be there. I want to be there right now.
You want to be there in the chair reading the book, though. You know what
I'm saying? Yeah.
That's where you want to be. Yeah. You want to be reading that. You don't want to be living it, but you want to be reading it for sure.
It's like almost like documentary to me. It's like a documentary of this. It's like a fake documentary, you know, of this time period. I guess much like Moby Dick is like a fake documentary of this incident, you know. So I don't know. So think about it differently every time. Again, I guess that is the enduring part. That's something. I guess that's what great literature does. It makes you think about it differently many times in life, I guess, you know.
Yeah. I haven't finished Blood Meridian. I just started it a week or two ago. I know. I can't wait. Yeah. But I'm with you on that. It doesn't seem to me, at least, to glorify the violence. Like, you know, after reading The Jungle by Sinclair, you're not gonna be really hungry for some sausages, you know.
You're like, that guy glorified working conditions, shitty working conditions.
Yeah, like, you know. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Hilarious.
But I'm with you on that.
So you were in Cleveland. You're saying you were in Cleveland when you first read Cormac McCarthy, right? Wow, that's super interesting to me. That's great. And what was your depiction? Did you have a vision of the Southwest, or how did your vision of the South? I'm interested because as somebody from here, I'm always interested at people who are not really from here and how they perceive this place.
Right.
I'm interested in how if you have an idea of how your idea of the Southwest or the Western.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been to Texas at one point, and you know. But having said that, you know, I've never been to New Mexico or Arizona or any of those truly those wasteland type areas where the Glanton gang is going around. But I think McCarthy conjures such a world with his language that I feel like I've been there, but the there that I've been is somewhere that McCarthy invented, right?
Yeah, totally.
And so it's not the real Southwest. In a sense, even if I wonder, even if I lived there, would it really be the real Southwest that I would be thinking of, you know, or that I would be imagining the book taking place in? Because it's very much immersive, and it's a very much an immersive environment. And it's kind of like how, you know, historical fiction is like that. You know, historical fiction is like that. You are traveling back in time to a time and a place that is far away from you. But in reality, you are traveling to the author's version of that time and place, you know?
Interesting. Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's like, you know, I've never been to Paris, but I know Godard's Paris, you know, Truffaut's Paris, you know.
Thanks.
So, yeah, I guess that's what happens when we associate a writer with a region and stuff like that, and know that region primarily through that artist, you know.
Right.
Interesting.
Fernando, how did you feel of the depiction of it? Like you said, as someone who is from there.
Let me think. You know, to me, okay, like, this is what I learned about Cormac McCarthy in my own writing. This is what I took. I was like, you know, he's very specific, especially No Country for Old Men, very specific about guns, the usage of the guns, how the guns work, even if it's done very minimally. So I'm like, okay, if I ever have a gun somewhere, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this like this, you know. And if anything, sometimes I make something up. Or I do something that is a little bit wrong, and as somebody who would know, or make something up, or, you know, if I have a brand of a gun, to make it change the wording just a little bit, you know? I don't know, just to have more fun, you know, just to kind of like, I don't know, just to mix it up for myself. So I'm like, I don't know. That's what I do. I've never been one to imitate a writer. I'm mostly like, I know, like, okay, I can stay away from that now. Okay, I don't have to write about this or that. These other writers got these turf covered, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Every writer influences you in a different way. And, you know, I'm excited to read one of his books again. I don't know which one it's going to be. So it'll be my first one since he died. So I don't
know. Mm-hmm. That kind of leads me to another question I have, and on that, you mentioned that you got your son hooked on The Road recently, right? And so I'm curious how, you know, if someone was like, you know, who's Cormac?
He's 15.
That's a good age.
Precocious 15. Yeah,
that's a good age. Yeah. I think I'd seen Reservoir Dogs by the time I was 15.
Yeah. I like that.
He's a precocious 15, and he's really into, you know, horror genre, like Stephen King. And he loves sci-fi, and he loves Stephen King, and so I figured this is nothing it's not going to traumatize him too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right up his alley. And what do you, what did you say to him? Like, oh, you gotta check out Cormac McCarthy
exactly. You know, I basically, you know, I have like a top shelf, top couple shelves, in this room over there where basically in my study where I have like, you know, my favorite books of all time. And he noticed that the same author was on there twice. And I was like, well, you can pick either one. It's going to be awesome. But The Road is probably the one you want to start with. And then I told him that mommy tried to read Blood Viridian, but couldn't finish it. And so he was like really interested in that one.
Yeah.
So I think he's going to find his way to that pretty soon. But he loved The Road, and he was like, this is the real thing. And, you know, he hasn't read that much quote unquote high literature, you know, which is kind of funny relative to what we talked about earlier. He's read a lot of genre fiction.
Yeah. And
this is kind of the first time where I was like, look, don't just pay attention to the story, pay attention to every last sentence that you're reading.
Right.
Just love the images for their own sake, you know, and it's not necessarily you're getting from point A to point B, but although that in The Road in particular, there's some interesting stuff that happens, but dwell on the sentences, you know? And so I do believe that, you know, this is one of his first aesthetic reads, language oriented reads that he's done. And he liked it and he understood, he completely understood, even a 15-year-old, well, a precocious 15-year-old, he understood that, look, there's more than one thing going on in this book. The plot and character that you're usually accustomed to experiencing, particularly in the kind of fiction that he reads and that most people read, to be honest with you, that's those are things that are going on, but there's a third thing that's going on, which is the language.
Yeah.
And I was glad that The Road was the novel that kind of introduced him to the concept as a reader.
Totally. It's a good way to trick them into reading something literary, you know. It's good. It's good.
I want to ask, what about McCarthy's writing you kind of touched on it already, but what about his work and also his, you know, approach to life and, you know, incorporating a love for science and I don't know. 'Cause for me, it's like, I'm very inspired by his, like we touched on before, not necessarily caring about the critics necessarily or the sales, and, you know, making the art that he wants to make, and also his, you know, appreciation, fascination of science and wanting to just learn and be excited excited about new things, about discovering new things, learning new things, and imagination. And that, you know, there's a certain imagination that is required in science as well as in writing, of course. So I'm just curious if there's any sort of things you've taken from his not only his writing but his just life in general that you've applied to your own lives.
You know, what is interesting, I guess, to me about also his trajectory is how, you know, nobody could do that even if they tried to or imitate it. You know, I think he was a product of a time and place, both it seems like in society. I guess he was able to live and not work really a lot and still somehow survive. It doesn't seem likely you could do anything similar to that now and still be writing. And, you know, maybe back then in the late 60s you could. And also you could send your manuscript cold to somebody at the publisher and they'd read it and they'd accept it miraculously, other than it just being forgotten like a pile of other manuscripts, you know. So those two things combined, it just seems like unique to him. It just seems like only he could have done these things. You know, it just seems like his trajectory and everything was tailor-made only for him, because nobody, even if you tried, could imitate, even if you tried to do one of those things, you know, could imitate those kinds of things, you know, and continue publishing books after your first one doesn't sell more than a few, not even 100 copies, probably, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So that's what's interesting to me. Like, you know, it's totally, you know, you couldn't imitate him even if you could, you know?
Yeah.
The writer in every kind of way, in the way he lived and the way he published. So that's what's interesting to me. I can't think of any other writer who seems that way, you know, who wasn't from the city, who lived rurally. Right. You know, it seems like it's very hard to be published if you live, if you don't live in New York, especially back then, especially back then, you know. So I don't know. And I don't think, and you know, as opposed to like someone like, I don't know, Larry McMurtry, he was not considered like a regional writer, you know. So it's interesting, but even though you could say that he was just, he wrote just as regional things as Larry McMurtry, you know. So I don't know. It's interesting to me. That's what's interesting to me about it. It just seems to me like if he wouldn't have done it, there wouldn't have been anybody like that ever, you know, or anybody who you could even say was like that, because he did it. Only one person could have done it, and it was him, you know.
Yeah, a singular talent, that's for sure. Well, we're getting close to the end here to wrap it up. Was there anything that we didn't cover about Cormac McCarthy?
See, you know, like, what? The one thing that I did want to add, and I didn't see, surprisingly, I didn't see almost anybody, nobody at all talk about this after he died. And it just so happens because I myself have written almost everything I've ever written in the same typewriter that he used. I've had the same typewriter since 2010, which is an Olivetti Underwood Lettera 32. And it wasn't until like 3 or 4 years ago that I discovered that it was the same typewriter that he had, just coincidentally. Oh. So what is interesting to me is that, you know, how much part, you know, this, his style could have probably been dictated by this machine. Because if you look at the only this particular typewriter, I highly recommend you look at the keys to this typewriter and check out how difficult it is to write an exclamation point. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because to write an exclamation point is such a pain, you know, in this machine, especially if you just want to move forward. And even to just put a, to put a quotation mark in this machine is kind of a pain too, you know. So you just want to move forward in this very, it's not a rudimentary machine. I always see this machine was like the iBook of its time, the iBook of 1962, you know, that machine, you know. So it's interesting to me, like somebody else, I can't think of an artist at the time, but another artist who the tool that they use also kind of like dictated their style, ended up dictating their style in many ways, you know.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. I think that's something worth observing and worth analyzing from other people who are more, you know, educated and stuff than I am.
No, I do like that. And I was going to mention that as well, because I remember when you came to the American Writer Museum, I don't know, 5 or 6 years
ago. 4 years ago. Yeah.
4 years ago for Tears of the Truffle Pig. I remember learning that you type everything on a typewriter. And I, you know, that came up in my research of McCarthy as well.
I think that's at the time, I found out that that's same typewriter.
Same one. Years, you know? That's cool.
So I wasn't surprised afterwards. I was like, oh, that makes sense to me.
Right.
You know, having used this machine and reading his work, it makes sense that that's the way it just reads, you know. Why go back and add all those things later, you know? Just, you know, take some space, you know? So I get it. I get it now, you know?
Yeah. It is interesting how the tool informs the work, you know? Like I know Maya Angelou always wrote, she would go to a hotel room and would write by hand on a yellow legal pad specifically. And then, but that sort of thing has always fascinated me, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, totally, totally. I'm always interested in how the sausage gets made, as they say.
That's right. Yeah. Well, thank you both.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing all your knowledge.
It's really, it kind of galvanizes me to kind of stop reading all the stuff that I'm currently reading and just go back to the oeuvre of Cormac.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
I've never read Sutri. I've never read.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I haven't read that one. So
that's my favorite one.
Oh wow. No. Okay. Great. I think that's gonna be.
Wow. Nice. I'm excited for you. You're gonna have a great time.
I'm excited for Nate because he gets to read Blood Meridian.
I know. Yeah.
You're both.
Any listeners who have not dipped into the well, have not gone skinny dipping with the judge yet. I envy them too.
Funny. I'm sure, you know, we didn't get to talk about it, but Sutri is funny. You know, I hope, I'm excited. I think that's his funniest one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Opinion, so,
I've heard about that. I heard that there's a lot of comedy in there.
Yeah. So that's awesome. I'm excited for you.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you both.
Thank you so much. Y'all have a very lovely day. Okay.
You too.
Yeah. Bye. You too. Thank you all.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Tuesdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.